All right, so while you're grabbing your second cup of coffee or whatever, just a reminder about the breakfast, 31st. So I'm assuming that all of you are signed up already, and if not, the sign-up sheet is up here. And if you're signed up, or once you're signed up, we still need some help to get some other people invited. And so I'm going to send around some cards, take a couple. See, if we can just get 200 guys signed up, then I can stop talking about this and being annoying. So if you'd rather listen to me lecture you every Saturday morning between now and the breakfast about what we need to do, then just don't invite people. If we get the list filled, then I'll stop talking about it. I think the ladies are at over 200. So at very least, a face-saving measure would be to come somewhere close to them, even if we can't top their number.
No. We are beating them. There's no...
Well, unless you're paying people to come in...
Burn the ships. That's it. My last great chance. Everybody have notes?
All right, so now on to a more positive note. Not that the breakfast isn't positive, but... and incidentally, just back to the breakfast for a minute. Website for you to go visit, Wade Wilson. I think it's .org. It could be .com. I'm not sure. It might even be on the breakfast tickets themselves on the back side. Tell you a little bit more about the speaker for the morning. Give you an idea of some of the things he's about. I'm looking forward to this being a very well done event. So that gives you an additional piece of enticement when you invite somebody else. There's going to be an outside speaker. We don't do that every year. All right, now, for those of you who helped or were involved in some way or another with our recent clothing drive that Vinny here has been involved in, I wanted us to get a sense of what's happened. And so I asked Vinny to write a small report. I'm just going to read the report. Probably make him a little uncomfortable, but that's okay. What a blessing it has been to both those who have received clothing through the support of the men and women at Morningstar and to my heart as a man with a dream in the last 2 months. And these are real numbers, so let's pay attention here. In the last 2 months, we've handed out over 50 articles of clothing, including long johns, jeans, hoodies, socks, gloves, boots, blankets, hats, and gift cards to Walmarts and Kohl's, when what we had was not what was needed. As we continue to minister to the physical needs of the people in our community, we also take the opportunity to share with them the love of Jesus and the reason we can have given them so freely what has been given to us, Jesus' eternal love and hope. That what has been lost in their lives can be found through relationship with Him. We also take the opportunity to invite them to attend Morningstar Men's Bible Study on Saturday, nice plug there, worship service Sunday morning, and celebrate recovery Wednesday nights to help them build a support team and to find healing over past hurts and freedom from addictions and compulsions. Sadly, one of the men we got to minister with, Steve, passed away a few weeks ago. He's been missed, but we rejoice that he came to salvation and was a believer in Jesus as his Lord, even as he struggled to make God the source of his life. And boy, there's a real mouthful right there. We started this dream with 5 out of 9 totes filled in our basement with clothing. And now, even after giving so much to those in need, we still have 7 full totes. Thank you, Jesus, for the support of the men and the women in this community and the leadership team at Morningstar. And thanks to each of you for your support of my family's dream to share hope and healing with the broken, hurt, and lost in our community through this new clothing vision. We continue receiving clothing, which is a reminder that the work isn't done yet. We continue receiving clothing donations, but have no specific needs at this time, except to ask continued prayer for courage and safety as we seek to share hope in Jesus with those who are stuck in lost and dark places right here in our own hometown. And then I've underscored this last line. How can we encourage the next dream from God to start? And if you remember, about 6 weeks ago or so, I said that it was my hope that over the course of the next year that there would be a number of initiatives that would begin here, that perhaps God was calling to one or another of you in addition to Vinny and placed some burden on your heart, and that we would have conversations in this group that would develop into larger conversations in the church as a whole about how we could bless additional communities of people that were in need. Well, isn't it good that we have an example, right, of something that has worked? Something that we have been able to do together that is a blessing. And so at least a couple of things have happened. Vinny and his family have been able to appreciate the at least somewhat completed vision of something that started as just a flicker, a dream in their minds. We have an example of the fact that, have you ever thought to yourself, I wonder if it's possible? I have this idea, but I wonder if it's possible. Well, see, we now have some hope because we know it's possible. It's possible to take something small and turn it into a tangible reality. And it doesn't matter if it's huge. I'll guarantee it's huge to the people who got some clothes, isn't it? It's really huge to them. And so I'd invite you, as I invited you before, listen to your heart. Listen to what God is calling to you to do. And I don't know what that might be. And then have the courage to maybe share it here. Or share it maybe with one or another of us privately, and we'll talk about it. And we'll see if we can't develop some action plan for getting a jump start. It's possible. All right. Is there anything else, while we're still on that subject, is there anything else that we can help you with at this time? Anything that you still need? So for right now, you're in good shape. All right. And continue to keep us updated. Let us know. Because you know what happens is we kind of forget things, move on to the next thing, and then we'll cycle around and it'll be the holidays again next year, and we'll say, I wonder if we can. So let's keep this ongoing. All right, so this week we're back in the series, What Would Jesus Say? We're going to look at the topic of conflict. I have to laugh. Now, you may not appreciate this, but it seems that there are often times when if you're going to talk about a particular topic, that you get reminders of why it's important to talk about the topic during your own personal life. In other words, what I'm saying is, on a week when I'm preparing to talk about the subject of conflict, what do you think the odds are that I would have some significant opportunities to have conflict in my own life?
100%.
Now, if you were the kind of person that saw God behind every last thing, you'd say, well, God prompted this. I think the reality is some combination of that and this. The fact that conflict is so inevitable, so likely, so pervasive, that it was almost inevitable that there would be some conflict in my life. How many of you have discovered that conflicts, beginning with small disagreements, can escalate really quickly?
Yeah.
And so, just to set a light tone before we get into some heavy stuff, a few evenings ago, my wife and I are at home together. That right there. There is the breeding ground for conflict all by itself. And I just innocently enough bent down and I noticed that there was a little cat toy. One of those little balls with a bell inside of it that was kind of lodged somewhere where a cat couldn't get to it. And I innocently enough bent down and picked it up and tossed it across the floor. And a cat ran after the cat ball. At which point my wife, who had a thousand things that she could have begun a positive conversation about, said, "Do you get the toys out from under the cabinet that I told you to get out the other day?" Now, being a guy, I did the next obvious thing. I said, "When did you tell me about that?" Yeah, you do know where this is headed, right? At which point she said, "Well, I told you about that the other day when we were at work. But of course, as usual, you didn't remember, did you?" I couldn't resist. I had to fan the flame somehow. It just seemed like it was proper at the time. And so I delved into a thoughtful appraisal of the fact that perhaps it might have been incumbent upon her to remind me at a time that was more opportune, such as when I was actually at home near where the toys were stuck, so that maybe I could remember it. And she said, well, if it was important, and if anything I said ever mattered to you, you would remember. But absolutely nothing that I say matters to you, does it? Why did she bait me like that? That seems unfair. No, it is not. Well, and before you know it, we'd moved from the cat toys to something that she had asked me to do on her car. And then from there it moved to, and I don't need to bore you with all the details, but I'm telling you that within 5 minutes, we had moved from an innocent discussion about a couple of stuck toys to a full-blown, and I would dare say even a little bit heated, interaction, we'll call it. Let's just call it an interaction. An exchange of ideas. Perhaps you've had similar exchanges of ideas.
Well, if you get rid of the cats...
No, I think that's just, I think that's perhaps a little bit of a buffer between us. That may be one thing that we actually have in common. All right. So we're going to just read through some of the things on the first page here. Conflict is all but inevitable. Peaceful resolutions are very optional. And so the first thing that I want to do, one of the first big ideas that I want to establish is this. And I'll introduce it in the form of a question. Have you ever felt inner turmoil or guilt because of conflict? Have you ever left a time of lively discussion, we'll call it that, and felt really bad afterward? And so I think sometimes we mistake being a believer for being a person who does not have real conflict. And yet that can't be true. Let's look at the next line. Conflict is the expression of disagreement. And not all expressions are verbal. So when we think of conflict, we usually think of it as verbal, right? Have you ever had conflict with someone and expressed your disagreement with someone and not said a word? Can you say slammed door, stomped feet, pouting? The obvious smoldering aura that occurs around someone that you can just tell. See, they're all forms of communication. And so what I think we're looking for here in the end is not that we avoid conflict, because conflict is actually good, and I think that's one of the things we want to establish here today. Conflict is good, conflict is necessary, certainly inevitable. How do we do it well? That's our end game here. How do we do it well, and how do we be at peace with ourselves while we're in the midst of that? So we're going to read through these bullet points. Because humans are each unique creatures, having varying perspectives based on past experience and personality and current or future desires, there will always be disagreement. So you see right there we have 3 points. We're different by nature. We're different by experience. And lastly, we're different by objective. In other words, what we want, what we're striving for. Now, if that's true, what are the odds that you're going to go through an entire week without some form of conflict? Just put those together. And this is true for every one of us. There's a lot of material that I'm going to be using this morning that is courtesy of a guy by the name of John Lederach. And he does a beautiful treatment of conflict and reconciliation. Well, anyway, this is one of his first assessments. You look throughout all the created order, you find no two things that are totally identical. Even identical twins are not, in all their thinking, in all their ways, perfectly identical. So if no two things are completely identical, how can you and I ever always have the same thoughts? The same ideas? So it's almost inevitable that there is going to be some disagreement. Now, where does disagreement come from? Disagreement comes from holding your ideas firmly and strongly. So a disagreement comes when you actually have a conviction about something and you're not willing to let the conviction go. How many of you would like to be people with no conviction? See what I'm saying? We all have convictions. How many of you would like to say at the end of your life, yeah, he stood for nothing and cared about nothing? So how can you and I stand for something, care about something, be passionate about something, live in a community with people who are equally so, and never have conflict? And I hope that at least that, when I spell it out like that, puts you at rest with the fact that conflict has to be normal. And yet, how many of you went into a significant relationship in your life? Let's say marriage. Marriage seems to be a good example for conflict. How many of you went into that relationship assuming that conflict would be minimal? And is it safe to say that you have found it to be somewhat different than you expected many years ago? All right, here we go. Next one. Disagreements often escalate beyond calm discussion because we are both intellectual and emotional beings. Remember Star Trek? I think it was Star Trek, right? Spock, right? The guy who was intellectual and rational but felt no emotion. Men and women are different. We've talked about this. But women tend to feel things in altogether different ways. As a matter of fact, when we did that whole marriage series, we talked about this one principle. That when a man remembers his past, he remembers it based on other things that were occurring at the same time. When a woman remembers the past, she remembers it based on what she was feeling at the same time. You understand? So when she says, what were we doing at a certain, or what, you know, let's talk about this thing from the past, I remember other things that I was doing at the time. She remembers how she felt at the time. Have you ever had a current issues conflict that in very short order started to regress toward things from the past? Remember the cat ball? It took 10 minutes. See, I only told you about the first 5 minutes. We're competitors. No one is going to go down in this fight easily. But I'm just being real, okay? I'm not saying I'm your role model for conflict. I'm just keeping it honest here. All right, within 10 minutes, we were talking about things that happened 20 and 30 years ago. Where did that come from? So we can all agree that we're both intellectual creatures and we're emotional creatures. So there again, the seeds for even deeper conflict. The way in which we handle disagreements can leave a lasting impact not only on personal relationships, but also on communities and countries and global populations. And so this is where we turn a corner and we move from stating the obvious to remembering what's at stake. The conflict that you have today, and remember what we just said, it'll be remembered. That fight from 5 years ago, you may have forgotten it. You probably forgot it within 2 or 3 days. Guess who's still remembering it? All you got to do is push the right button. It's there in living color and all its vibrancy, fresh as the day it was just had. So what does that tell us? It tells us that we need to be careful and diligent about the way we have conflict because it's going to keep coming around. It's kind of like a comet. Every so many years, it's just going to cycle around again, and you're going to see it. And I'm trying to throw a little humor into it, but isn't it true? So we need to be careful about what we sow in the present because it's going to grow for the future. Even the way we have conflict. Conflict is at heart a lack of harmony or a lack of complementary viewpoints, and with this understanding, we can easily state that persons often find themselves with unresolved internal conflict. So have you ever left a discussion with another person and been in as much inner turmoil as you felt there was external turmoil between the two of you? So in the end, the goal is, and here's the goal is to have peaceful relationships with other people, but also to be at peace with yourself. Because I think there are times when we carry around either guilt or unresolved inner turmoil. We can take that around with us for weeks. You know who finds that out? Everybody we work with. Everybody else that we see in life. Yeah, there is nothing exactly the same as no disagreement, right, is forever stifled. People will know that you disagree with them. No inner lack of inner peace is forever held within. Sooner or later, it comes out. All right. We'll jump down to the last one. As we each know from personal experience, conflict can be destructive, leave lasting wounds, often leaves residual scars which render the people involved different from that point on and can fester and remain unresolved for years or even centuries. And so what I'm saying there is that I believe in the course of the conflict that you have, remember conflict, just the natural expression of disagreement, it can significantly transform relationships and significantly transform people. In other words, the understandings that you build into people, their experience, the understandings that you build into people based on their experiences with you is going to set the tone for how they will understand and experience life from that moment on. So I would like to say, and I'm sure that if there were a female in the room, she would disagree, but I would like to say that we being not lacking in emotion, but called to lead and perhaps being able to separate at times emotion from intellect, we're called on to be discerning and careful about the way in which we guide conflict. And I think that might be a good word. So if we can't avoid conflict, and I don't think we want to, we simply need to guide it. And so I think these are our objectives. And we just move a little bit further down the page here. To be respectful and even honoring of all parties. All right, so I'm sure we can all think of times when we didn't have that as an end result, right? The conflict moved beyond something that was respectful and honoring. How does that happen? I mean, I can tell you how it happens, but why don't we have a conversation about that? How do we move from a simple disagreement that is expressed to something that becomes dishonoring?
We decide we're right, regardless of our colors.
It's not that we're right, it's the other person's decision.
Okay. And we all know that to be true, at least sometimes, do we not? And so what you're really saying is that there would be no conflict were it not for stupid people in the world.
Exactly.
So there must be a lot of them in the world because there's so much conflict. We're going to get into that in a few minutes, actually.
That's why we have responsibility.
All right, so seriously, what else? So we become... And we both said the same thing here. We hold our opinions tightly. We have strong convictions. But there's another thing that's missing. How is it that we move from a respectful discussion on something that we disagree with to something that dishonors someone? Okay, and you verbalized it right there. You see, it's when we move from you are a noble individual, and we'll look at that second point, an image bearer of God who has a different viewpoint, and perhaps I could learn from that, and you move from there to I lump together you and the opinion that you have that I differ with. And the moment that I lump you and your opinion together, what happens? Now you become my enemy, not just the idea becomes something that I need to understand. That's a really tough thing. That I think we need to... And let me just say this. We'll back up and we'll talk about marriage again. How many of you thought when you got married that marriage was something that you should just be able to figure out? Right? How hard could it be? Would you agree that a person who gets no training in marriage throughout the entirety of their married life will probably not do it well? I mean, whether it's formal or informal, whether you get it from a book, whether you get it from showing up at seminars, whether you just get it from going and visiting your grandmother or your grandfather and having conversations with them because they've lived longer and experienced more. There's things that we just need to learn about being human. And I think in the same way, we need to learn how to have conflict well. So again, coming back to the guilt or the false guilt. No one should assume that they are born with excellent conflict resolution skills. They need to be learned. So if we haven't taken the time to study, evaluate, and learn better means of having conflict, we're going to continue to have conflict in the same way. Oh my. A servant's heart. Thank you, John. All right, so our first two goals, to respect the other party, to preserve and enhance our status and their status as image bearers. And what do I mean? That somewhere in each of us is the likeness of God. Something about every human being carries with it the stamp and the brand of God on it. And when we link the disagreement to the person and devalue the person, we're devaluing their image-bearing capability. And incidentally, if that's true and we disagree with the other person, have you ever disagreed with God? Well, I mean, nobody actually comes right out and says, well, yeah, okay, maybe they do. But most people don't. But have you ever just thought God got it wrong? So, what are we saying when we're saying that we disagree with another person? Possibly, we just don't understand everything that is to be understood, because if we already say that God, whom we claim to say knows everything, we disagree with Him, and we say He's got it wrong, then why is it unreasonable to think that other people who are image bearers of God, we just assume that they've got it wrong too? That by itself is pretty unsettling. All right, the next thing, protect our own inner peace. What's the price of inner peace? Remember, these are all goals. So we've said to honor each party, to preserve and enhance each person's image-bearing qualities as a child of God, or at least a creation of God, if not a child of God yet, protect our own inner peace. What's the price of inner peace? Is it worth something to you? Bring the best solutions possible. Isn't that what we want in the end? And that's a tough thing to... Here's the dilemma that we face. I want to be right, or I want the best solution. What if the best solution is the other person's solution? Or some hybrid of the two? What does it require for you to be okay with not being right? Have you ever thought about that? Because just as much as... Here's the other thing that we do, and we haven't even talked about that yet. The same as I link you and your opinion, I link me and my opinion. And in order for me to be wrong, I almost have to devalue me too. That's what happens when we start to connect who we are with what we think. See, we already know, we've had how many countless conversations, we already know how obvious it is that I am not what I do. Right? When we look at work and we say, well, when a man loses his job, if he is what he does, what is it when he doesn't work? Well, couldn't the same be said? If I am what I think, what am I when I'm wrong? Do you see why it's likely that we're going to continue to hang on to our opinions as long as we think that we are what we think? And lastly, and this ultimately is our goal, and Jesus talks about this so much, it's to bring about the kingdom of heaven on earth. So I guess an interesting question at this point might be, how closely would you say that your sphere, the world that you live in, your unique world, that encompasses your relationships and your circumstances, how much does that look like the kingdom of God on earth? And how much does it look like the kingdom of hell on earth? All right, a couple more points. Some conflicts concern those things which have transpired. In other words, they're in the past. There's a present disagreement stemming from a past problem or offense. There's a present resentment or a spirit of offense which prevails in the present because of the past grievance. Can you picture that? You've never brought reconciliation to some past thing. Another gender difference that we've talked about. I think most men have experienced this, even if they haven't found words to put to it. You and I as males can tend to put an offense behind us, frankly, not so much because we want to put it behind us. We just move on to the next thing. Have you ever noticed that a woman can hang on to something a little bit longer? The thing that you actually would need to refer back to a journal from 20 years ago and look that thing up, she's still got it vividly in mind and remembers it. How do we help all parties to bring resolution to something and an understanding that you can't continue to relive the past? Is it the same as you and I need to know our qualities and tendencies? Which means that we can ignore things, we can be indifferent to things, we can not pay attention to things and leave the toys under the cabinet when they should have been extracted from the cabinet, or actually important things. We need to be able to help those whom we're having conflict with to understand where they may have a blind spot or a weak point. So what's our goal in the conflict? Is it to bring about the best result, which means healing for everyone and a better understanding? Or again, I return to the idea, or is it to be right? Some conflicts concern an ongoing dispute. It was, it is, and it will probably be forever. What do you do about that? And we even have a phrase for that, don't we? The conflict that was, that is, and always will be. What do we call it? We've agreed to... Yes. Isn't that funny? We have such a memorable phrase. I'll bet you 90% of you knew that phrase as soon as I started. Do we honestly agree to disagree? Do you wake up every morning and say, it's good to disagree? Or do you wake up every morning and say, when are they finally going to come around to my point of view? Okay, I wake up every morning. Maybe none of you do. I know I wake up some mornings and think to myself, boy, this might be the day. Hope springs eternal, doesn't it? This might be the day.
Make it better if I pray for them.
How do we live, and this is a good conversation point, how do we live with ongoing disagreement and yet be at peace? Now, some of you are what we'll call seasoned veterans of life. You've got at least one or two gray hairs. What have you learned about that? What have you learned about it? Because surely every one of us has experienced this. Okay. Anything else?
A lot of times it's judging how important the issue is. You know, you agree to disagree, it's because it's not worth the battle. You know, okay. Keep our tanks close to each other. There's no reason to fire.
Because the wounding and the loss of whatever would be lost is greater.
The field's more important than the...
Exactly.
All
right. And we've already covered this last point, that in the heat of the moment, when everything surfaces, one thing reminds us of something else that reminds us of something else that reminds us of something else. Is there a person in the room who hasn't had that discussion? Where one thing leads to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, and pretty soon you're just at each other's throats? You haven't had that?
No.
I wanted to have an inner... No, we were going to bring you to the front of the room. That's what we were going to do.
My wife and I have found a way to argue and not end up blowing up each other. And what we try to do early on, we decide whether or not one of us is going to be swayed. Like, whether there's a chance that, you know, how strongly held, how firm you are in your, in, you know, standing your ground. And then if we decide we're not going to come to some, you know, once the leader, we're not going to come closer to the matter, we immediately start working on the resolution. Like, what, okay, now what are we going to do so that we're both satisfied? And that helps us. And that's the thing. We don't blow up. We decide, this is what I think, this is what you think, and then we got to do something. There's got to be some way to work together and not demand. That's kind of how we handle it.
At what point in your relationship did you, either in a moment or gradually, arrive at that sort of formula?
It took a couple of years to kind of get it. We didn't. We're both kind of laid back and easygoing, so it didn't come up a lot. But once it started coming up, things started, you know, kids and just life started coming at us full speed, buying a house, stuff like that. It took a couple of years, and we just kind of decided we didn't want to fight because we hated the time that we weren't home. So,
did you hear something else in that he said? Because when we listen to other people's stories, sometimes we say, well, I wish I could be like that. But he self-described and described his wife as being, we're pretty easygoing. This is why this is not my mascot, because I am not really easygoing. Now, I know that probably surprises most of you, but...
That's a key phrase, because as he said that, my wife and I both are not laid back and easygoing.
Right.
And so you have to learn, trial and error, how we're going to do this.
Ooh, and there's another one. So, yes.
I was saying that in my marriage, it hasn't been good. We were on the brink of divorce. I remember my second marriage, the one I'm in now. The only reason that we have lasted is because I learned it wasn't just about letting go of my opinions, my convictions, my feelings of being right or wrong, but about understanding and giving her grace. That I actually did a drawing because it's just the way on my heart. My wife sees this spiral of whatever I've done and would say, I am a liar, I am a thief, I am a whatever. Whereas I would see it as, I lied this time, and I lied this time, and
right.
I lied this time. Yes, I did, but they're all individual events. And so during a calm period, I went to her and I said, you know, it's funny because I see your point, but I see it differently. Can we talk about it? And having gone through that, we came to a point where, like, I had broken bones in my hands from hitting walls and hitting people. And I could say to her, look, the reason I got to that extent is because I couldn't walk away. I wanted to be right regardless of the outcome. I don't want that here. But if I call a timeout, it means I need to go because I'm no longer processing what's going on. I'm responding in anger. And I had to ask for her forgiveness. I had to go to my children. I didn't have to. I knew God was asking me and inviting me to be the dad that my kids needed. And I went and asked for forgiveness for having spanked in anger, for other punishments in anger. And right away, I noticed a change in our marriage. We can have the conflict knowing the end result wasn't divorce. And so we don't, it doesn't have to go that way. We can say, that's a really different point of view. I don't agree with any of that. I don't see any of that. I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me. But there's a commonality. Okay, well, it's kind of cool too, because you see me really differently. But I'm no longer defined. My identity is no longer defined as whatever the struggle was in our marriage. And I'm free to have a different opinion. And I'm also free to listen to her opinion. And sometimes she has some amazing ideas, things I never would have thought of. And I believe I was conned into lies, believing that when you get married, you become one, and the wife is to complete the marriage, or to complete me. And that is just a lie.
Mm-hmm.
What I've learned is if we're broken together, we're much, much stronger when Christ is the center.
Good stuff. All right, so momentarily, we're going back to the garden. We're going to revisit the story that we know so often. It's the don't eat the fruit. And most times we focus on, well, he ate the fruit, she ate the fruit, they did this bad thing, they got kicked out of the garden. But we overlook the tree that the fruit came from. Does anybody remember the tree? the knowledge of... Okay. So what would it have meant to be free of the knowledge of good and evil? And then what would it mean to an individual to know good from evil, right from wrong? And look at how things, we talk about a spiral. Look at how quickly things spiraled out of control. How many generations did it take before people were killed? One. Think about how quickly things spiral out of control. The real death occurred not just in separation, but the real death occurred in, I know the difference between right and wrong, but somehow I seem powerless to act for the right and not the wrong. Okay, so point of personal confession, in the middle of an exchange, and incidentally, didn't the brothers' conflict, I mean, wasn't that a conflict? It really was, right? It was an unresolved conflict. Well, actually, it was resolved in the end, right? It was resolved, and it wasn't affirmatively resolved. Don't we all have times when deep down inside we know we're not responding rightly, but we do it anyway? I mean, even to this day, or am I the only one? Maybe I am the only one. I don't know. But you see, to this very day, we still struggle with the same thing. This is the dilemma from the garden on. We know right from wrong, but we don't always practice that. And what do I become when I know what I should do, but I don't do it? What did they do?
Hide.
They hide. So they hide from God. In reality, they're probably hiding from each other too. And I go inside myself. Because myself is the only place that I know to go when I'm going to hide. But I know something about myself too, because after all, I now have the knowledge of good and evil. So what do I know about myself? Yeah. So what do I do when the only place I have to hide is the same place that I know isn't always good? That presents a real problem. Just hang on to that idea. There is so much of what we have in the way of conflict that we know right from wrong sometimes, but we don't know how to deal with it. Isn't that humanity's dilemma? In every generation, technology outpaces morality. Or ethics, we'll call it. We have technology that brings us to ethical dilemmas that we didn't have before. And always, in every generation, our ability to do surpasses our ability to understand how or if we should do. All right, so we're going to come down to now three different types of conflict: relational, task, and process. So in a relational conflict, we don't share core values. So what does that lead to? If you had to describe one thing that was essential for a marriage to last, or one of a handful, would you include respect in that?
Yep. Honor and respect.
Honor and respect. When I no longer embrace the same values as someone else, when I believe that they don't embrace good values, how easy is it for me to respect them? And let's be honest, have you ever come to a point in your marriage where you didn't respect the person that you were married to? Or perhaps they didn't respect you any longer? My suggestion, my thought is that at this point, if this is a non-negotiable relationship, that you probably need help. And it's not a sign, for whatever reason, I went online yesterday and I wasn't looking for this. It's just, there it was, right up there in one of the front things. It was 10 things about marriage that people used to think that they've come to discover aren't true. And a lot of them had to do with conflict. I don't know what that was all about, but... And one of the things that it said was that when a couple gets to the point where they have profound differences, they really strongly dislike each other, that the relationship can go one of two ways. Somebody can be brave enough to share with the other person exactly why and how much they don't like the other person. Is it? It can either lead to a breakthrough or a blow-up that's irreconcilable. But I think that there are times when if we get the help of someone else to have that discussion, that it can keep us from completely running off the rails. So if the conflict has gotten to the point where you no longer respect the other person, yet you must work with them, some outside party, I think, is essential. So the next kind of conflict is a task-related conflict. It's simply, how do we do something? Parents have task-related conflicts all the time. Do we let Junior do this, or do we do that? Do we discipline Junior this way, or do that way? And we're going to differentiate task from process, just so that we understand it clearly. To understand process, we'll call this the method, and let's look at our own political system. Would you say that in general, most Americans want a prosperous and thriving economy? They want to borrow Roosevelt's words, a chicken in every pot. They all want a good job. Would you say that as Americans, we have a core set of things, assumptions that we agree on? Do we agree on the process that will get us to that?
No.
So that's the difference between process, is the overall, it's not just one thing, it's do we raise this tax or do we cut this thing. It's the overall, how do we conceive that we could possibly get from here to there. It's the roadmap from here to there. Tasks are, do we take this fork in the road or that fork in the road? We can see that we disagree a lot about that. And so we come back to what Brian said, which is somewhere in the notes too. It's like, what's at stake if we don't do it your way? What's at stake if we don't do it their way? That's a task question. If I don't get my way in this, what's the worst that can happen? Do we end up at a cliff? Do we end up at a dead end where there is no hope from there if we go your way instead of my way here? And the reason that as a country we have so much discussion about process is because in certain respects we don't actually share the same values any longer. And so when we no longer share the same values, we can't even agree on the process to get to what, because we're not even sure where we want to get. So I guess another question that we need to ask is, in the important relationships in your life, do you both value the same things and are you both going in the same direction? And we all know couples, and the reason I keep coming back to marriage is because it's just, isn't that such an obvious place to discuss conflict? I mean, we can take conflict into the workplace, we can take conflict out into the world, and we're going to look at that a little bit. But the home is where we really practice this. And as a matter of fact, here's what I believe. If you can't get it right in the home, how will you ever get it right in the world? Like, if we can't learn how to have, and I don't mean be doormats, I don't mean be docile and passive and not hold anything closely or dearly, but if we can't intelligently learn how to have meaningful conflict that brings about a good resolution in the home between a few people, how in the world can we ever have a world where billions of people can get along with each other? Incidentally, when we have this conversation, think about the dream of the kingdom of heaven. Think about the challenge of being God. Just that's a good meditation exercise sometime. All right, so with this done, notes here so I can find this. All right, we're going to look at a couple of diagrams, but if you'd like to, we're on the back, I guess it's the back of your first page, down near the bottom, how to create an enemy. And And we're just going to read these three, and then we're going to diagram this a little bit. Separate yourself from the other person. Focus on how you are different rather than what you share in common. Now we're going to move this out into the population as a whole. I was asking this question of myself yesterday. What kind of a person does it take? I don't know if you have any political leanings. And I don't want you to share them here. I just want you to think about them, right? So whatever your political leanings are, what happens when you disagree with the people that you are loyal to? Have you ever found yourself disagreeing with people that you're close to and loyal to? Have you ever found yourself disagreeing with the team who you are on? So let's say that, for purposes of discussion, let's say that you are either a Republican or a Democrat. And please, let's keep this a friendly conversation, okay? What happens? See, you have a commonality with your group, which is us. But what happens when us does something that you think is absolutely stupid? Do you feel inner conflict? Like, if you have set them up as being wrong, but them happens to share your viewpoint on something, what do you do with that? Do you understand what I'm saying? Have you ever experienced that? I'm seeing a lot of blank stares. Maybe not.
I have denominationally in churches.
Oh, there you go. Let's bring some of that.
I'm game.
Back to what are your core values? What's your foundation? What are your beliefs? Then you filter all that through them. That's what happens. Yeah.
But when we build a strong connection with us, how difficult is it to be courageous enough to say, in this matter, I take a stand that's aligned with them? And when we set ourselves up, remember this first point, how to create an enemy? Separate yourself from the other person. Focus on how you are different rather than what you share in common. Isn't that what we do here? We set up these artificial divides. Point number two, build yourself up in your own mind as being morally superior. Build your own image on the foundation of their wickedness rather than independently and objectively. Do you understand what he said? You are who you are simply because you're better than they are. Now, I know you would never say this in your marriage, but do you know more than your wife? Are you smarter than your wife? Do you have better reasoning skills?
Now, I'm all scared.
Huh?
I'm all scared. Not on any given day.
Was there a time when you were?
Absolutely.
Okay. Don't we do that subtly, though? See, we're not overt about that. We're not obvious about it. But sometimes, why would you think that your opinion was right and hers was wrong? If you're not somehow capable of better thinking than she is, why in the world would you ever think that your opinion was right and hers was wrong? Tell me how you can reconcile that. And so we do. It's really hard to detach yourself from a feeling of superiority when you believe that you're right. And that's why I want to say this is so embedded into us, it's just really difficult to dig out. And then finally, dehumanize the other person and remove from them their image-bearing quality. They're no longer on the same par with you, and they no longer carry any of God's qualities or attributes. Now, I know we wouldn't get to that point with those close to us, but we can really easily see how that happens out in the public sphere. So what do we share in common? So if we view all of life as this, and we are each inside the common, we're not always going to have overlapping interests, but our larger interests are great enough to keep us together. So think about the relationship that you have the most conflict with right now, most conflict in. Do you have any large overlapping interests that are so great that it's worth pursuing resolution? And this is where we get hung up in marriage. What happens in a marriage that causes that to break apart? What are the large interests that a married couple probably should have? We can make a list of them. And again, this is not strictly a discussion on marriage. It's just that marriage is such an easy way to understand this. What are some of the large issues that, even though you disagree about things, they're shared interests? Okay, and we assume that they're successful, development, maturity, prospering, all of that. So the well-being of the kids. What else?
It has to be more than that, because they grow up and leave home. Then you're left with each other. Stuff.
Right. Boy. And then you're reduced to fighting over cat toys. So rent some kids if you need to. Don't let them leave home. What else?
Shelter, the home itself, the house.
Okay. How about, let's call that survival? Can we call it that? Because it's more than that. It's all the basics that... Incidentally, if you wonder why there were fewer divorces going back hundreds of years ago, and it's not as if there were no divorces, but if you wonder why there were fewer, it's because this was more difficult.
Yes.
When this was more difficult, people were more tied to each other and desperately needed each other. So it didn't matter if you liked the other person. Could you imagine being stuck on a ship for a trans-Pacific crossing, which takes a little bit longer than an Atlantic one? Right? You would pretty soon find out everything you did not like about every other shipmate you had, wouldn't you? But you all had a shared common interest that had to override all of your petty personal disagreements. And so for the sake of all of you getting across, you put all of your differences behind you. Today's survival, believe it or not, is a lot easier. We have more social safety nets that catch people when they detach from relationships. And so this is no longer as much of a pull in a relationship. What else do you share? Which is part of the survival, but it's also part of shared goals and dreams, right? So if you divide the finances, your capability to achieve shared goals and dreams is diminished. You spell that right? Looks kind of right. And I'm going to write as a subset of that shared goals.
Yeah. Goals, dreams, values. Mission in life. What about your mission?
There we go. Now, he may be uncomfortable with this, but the note that I read from Vinny, it's not just signed Vinny. Well, it's actually not signed, but that's only because he sent it to me in an email. It's signed Vinny and Vicky. And the implication throughout this letter is that this is not just Vinny's dream. It's their dream, and it's something that they're working on together. Now, maybe he was more passionate about it at the beginning, and I'm not even going to ask him, but the way this is presented to us, the understanding that I gather is that this is a shared commitment. And so what happens if they separate? What happens to their shared commitment there? The shared ministry, their shared mission, what happens to that? It loses power at very least, or it disintegrates altogether at its worst. So there's another question. Do you and those close to you share common mission that is of greater value than the differences that you have? And I think it's interesting that in a day when we have so much, There are so few marriages where the couple is living for something bigger than their own personal enjoyment. If you were to track the objectives and the goals of the typical couple, it's get married, buy a house, have some kids, successful kids preferably, so we can point to them later in life and say, we did that. And when the successful kids have moved out of the house and hopefully not moved back home, what's the end game and what's the end goal?
You work for retirement.
You work for retirement and you work toward living a happily ever after life, primarily self-indulgent. Do you suppose, honestly, that that's what we're here for? Or could there be more to live for? So again, maybe when you go home, when I go home today, we ask this question of ourselves, to my mate and I, or to those other important relationships that I share, you know, one-on-one or all of us together, are we living on a mission that is so important that whatever conflict we're having needs to be resolved for the sake of keeping the mission afloat? So while I'm taking a break to regroup, is there any conversations or anything that questions, comments? This has to be such a personal issue that you must feel this.
You know, there's how to create an enemy, being able to put it into words and raise some questions in my heart. There, with whom have I done this? To whom do I owe amends? Who do I need to forgive without expecting anything back? And do I really believe that resolution is possible and that it has value in my life?
I really like that last one. Can you read that again?
Do I really believe that resolution is possible and that it has value in my life?
So it implies there that there is a price to be paid in some way or another for resolution. So what's the price that will be paid for some sort of reconciliation, we'll call it? And is it worth the price? But you've also expressed another idea, which is, are there relationships for which you have lost all hope and therefore you assume that from this day forward it will always be in this condition? And so there was a time when you expected that you could have a meaningful and a rich relationship, but your level of hope is diminished to the point that survival is just the noblest goal that you could imagine. We'll just deal with this thing. We'll grit our teeth until the end. I don't know why, but every once in a while I think about that old Meatloaf song. The one where, so now I'm praying for the end of time. Do you remember that? That line, right? Huh?
It's 2 out of 3.
All right, let's turn over to Matthew 18. So whether it's in his intention to do so or not is hard to say, but I believe that collected in this chapter are a number of things that have to do with conflict, although it's not immediately obvious that the chapter begins that way. So we'll just read a couple of verses from the beginning of the chapter here, starting at verse 1. At that time the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." It's an interesting question to begin a discussion about a kingdom with, because what's necessary for a kingdom? And unity. A certain amount of unity is necessary. If no one is willing to serve under the king, how can there be a kingdom? If there are no shared goals and purposes, how can there be a kingdom? But yet, what is their first question? Who's going to be greatest in this kingdom? Well, how does it make you feel when somebody else is up there asking you who's going to be greatest in this kingdom? What's the unstated but obvious assumption?
Pick me.
Oh, in order for somebody to be the greatest in the kingdom? There's a number of people who are going to be the least in the kingdom, aren't they? So when you ask the question, who's going to be greatest in this new kingdom, you're also looking for an answer to, who's not going to be so great in this kingdom? Well, are you not?
I'm just thinking, you know, even when we think, boy, they're not getting it. They're not getting 3.5 years Jesus has been with these guys. And this is what they come up with. Jesus, the master teacher. Yeah.
I always thought it odd that they don't say who's second in command. No, Jesus is the greatest.
Right.
So,
well, that's where they're going. Yeah, where are we going to sit? Right, left end, you know, where are we going to be? Yeah. Pick me, pick me.
Okay, but let's be honest. In what ways is that attitude something that we carry with us? In everything that we do. In some way or another, it seems to be part of our ingrained human nature. And it's something that needs to be worked out of us over time. And then we jump down to verse 10 here. See that you did not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven their angels always see the faces of my Father who is in heaven. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them is gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountain and go and search for the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I say, he rejoices over it more than the 99. What makes the sheep go astray? Because this is not about sheep, we all know that. And you could read that and you can divorce it from the previous statements, but what if you put them together? See, what if you and I are so busy asking the question, how can I be the greatest? Do we know outsiders that don't feel as if they have much to offer? They don't find any way to fit into our community. And when they don't find any way to fit into our community because we're all great in one way or another and they're not so great at much of anything, what happens to that one sheep that doesn't have anything that it's great at? What does it do? If I can't fit into this community, I may as well just walk away from this community. I mean, we can have all the lectures we want about how sheep are dumb and sheep are stupid and sheep don't know, you know, they don't have an internal compass and they drown in 6 inches of water, and all that might be true, but there's another reality that we rarely talk about, and that is that sheep don't leave all the time when things are good. Sometimes sheep leave because they don't see anything good there. So the question that we maybe need to ask at times, is it possible that we drive people out of our presence and out of our company because we have that superior attitude? And then we move on from there to this familiar passage about, we'll call it conflict resolution. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. But if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every charge may be established by the evidence of 2 or 3 witnesses. And if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Now, I read the whole of it first on purpose. But I want to come back and I want to look at this first part. Why is it so difficult for us to one-on-one go and confront people about things? What's necessary here? Yeah. How to what?
How to have power and confidence with people. And in the first chapter, he talks about we're all egotistic. So we all have this ego. And when our egos are hurt, that's when we have power and mind. Forget where I was going with the analogy there.
No, but you've answered a question. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. That assumes that you're aware of that. And it assumes that the sin has in some way or another, the perceived sin has wounded you. What does it take to come to someone in a non-threatening way and say, you've wounded me?
I get over the fear of what their thoughts might be when you say it. You tell them something they don't agree with. You've got to be able to see an error and accept what they believe.
When I become vulnerable, when I express to you, you've hurt me or you've wounded me in this way, there's a fear that I might be rejected. There's a fear that I might be rejected, but what are the other fears? I mean, we're men, right? How can a man be wounded or injured, right? What does that say about me when I'm wounded or injured? What does that sound like? It sounds kind of soft and petty, right? Doesn't it? It sounds like this instead of my real mascot, doesn't it? I knew I'd find a way to use it somehow. So, I feel perhaps like less of a man. We said in a controlled way. Now what happens when you've been sinned against? What happens when someone has wronged you? What emotions? Here we go. Remember what we said early on? That we are both intellectual and emotional creatures, and it is very difficult for us to have an intellectual or rational conversation only, that in very short order emotion comes into it. How do conversations go when you're angry? They feel really great for 30 seconds, don't they? They really do. Let's be honest. They do. But after that, it goes badly. There's something else that's not being discussed here. What's the thought process that a person will have to go through before they confront somebody else? What would it take for you?
Trusting the other person's not going to injure you further. Or at least hope.
Doesn't that raise the issue of superiority? Are they as noble a creature as I am? If I go to have a conference or a conversation with them and express my concern to them, are they really a noble person who will be able to listen to me? Are they reasonable? Or are they more barbaric? Top of the last page, while we're having this discussion, four voices which must be heard: truth, mercy, justice, and peace. Just keep those words in mind as we're having this discussion. What else is necessary? If you think about it, are you not going to plan this conversation? It assumes that there's some distance between, because it says, go. The person isn't with you. Go and have the conversation with them. A person who goes into a confrontation like this unprepared is likely not going to have a good result. And so what Jesus is really instructing us to do, and this is a guideline, I believe, for how we should have conflict with each other and how we should address those conflicts. But a person who goes into this unprepared is probably not going to find a good result. There's another thing that we might want to ask. And we don't want to absorb other people's responsibility and make that our own. But always in every confrontation, we're going to say, is there any part of this that I own? Is there anything about this issue which is mine to own, and maybe I need to do a little bit of confessing while I'm there? And we'll pause there for a moment and we'll come up and look at these four voices. What do you suppose that truth wants to say in every conflict? And what the author does here, he says, allow each of these four things to find a voice in this conflict. What would truth be saying if truth were a person in this conflict? What would he say right now? Yes, he would, wouldn't he? How clear things were. Have you ever noticed that two sides have different truth? So whether it's black or whether it's white, I suppose, depends on which side of the divide you're on. There is black and white, but it just depends on which side of the table you're sitting on. Yes. What does mercy want to say? Mercy is going to want to overlook something. It's going to want to have compassion and demonstrate, okay, I guess I could see myself in that situation. I probably... What happens when truth and mercy are separated, though? What happens when I rush to mercy but don't deal with truth? And then we come to the third voice, which is justice.
Yeah, there's no resolve. There's no resolution. Jesus was grace and truth. He is.
And so... when we seek to... Have you ever done this in a conflict? Maybe with someone close to you. Have you ever avoided having the difficult conversation and just whitewashed over it and pretended that it was okay? What happens then? Huh? It does get worse. At very least, it gets... Remember what we talked about early on? One of the objectives is that we have inner peace as well as honoring others. When you whitewash over an issue, do you have inner peace? When you say it's all okay when it's really not, do you have inner peace? And if you don't have inner peace, we've already established this, what happens? Your inner peace comes out, lack of inner peace comes out somewhere, doesn't it? And then finally at the end, peace is the final outworking of this. But there is no peace if these first three are not kept in proper check and balance. And so these make good guiding principles to facilitate this confrontation here. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. And if he listens to you, you have gained your brother. But if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. Now, believe it or not, even this is hard. Huh?
So you can embarrass them if
some... But we don't really want to get two or three witnesses, do we? What do we really want? We want two or three people that are on our side. What is a witness? A witness is an impartial party. And you know what we're afraid of? We're afraid that the witness might think that we're wrong and the other side is right, so we want to pick our witnesses carefully. And if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And then finally, if he refuses to listen to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Now, when you and I read this, what is our common interpretation of that? Let him be as a Gentile and a tax collector to you. Thanks, John. Right. And isn't that the way many in Jesus' audience would have heard that? But is that really what Jesus is saying? It's because there's two ways to interpret this text. I can interpret this as the hearer, the first century Jew, might have interpreted based on his understanding, or I can interpret these words through Jesus' behavior. How does Jesus treat tax collectors and Gentiles? Huh?
He goes to dinner.
Yeah, he goes to dinner with them. And so you and I usually, and this is, I believe, perhaps a flaw in this interpretation, you and I usually look at this and say, oh, from this moment on, I have nothing to do with him until he repents in sackcloth and ashes, humbles himself, comes to me crawling over broken glass on his hands and knees. When that happens, then perhaps I'll forgive him.
This stinks, right? My brother who I love is messing up and hurting me, and then I go through all this and I got to treat him as my brother who I love.
Right. And the only thing, what do you suppose Jesus means by this? Because there are some clear guidelines. As a tax collector and a Gentile, what would be the firewall that I would place there, but yet what would be the openness? This is a very instructive little phrase here. I would be guarded about opening up my deepest, most inner self to this person. It would be clear at that moment that there were certain values that we didn't share. It was assumed that the tax collector maybe did not share certain things. As a matter of fact, what was a tax collector viewed as? Someone who might prey on the individual, take advantage of the individual. Wasn't that the charge that was often leveled against tax collectors? That they took what was theirs, they took what was Rome's, and then they took a little bit more.
Even if they're only doing what they were supposed to do, they're part of a different system. Right? It was a Roman tax collector. They were Jews. It was a separate. There was a separation in the very nature of it.
But in Jesus' mind, there was always the looking out for an opportunity when this person might be open and receptive and things could be forgiven.
He treated them basically like they did not have a real understanding. So he's making a connection there still. They don't understand.
And so rather than washing her hands of them and being done with them once and for all, what he's saying is we should be on the lookout for ways in which we still can continue to serve them and guide them and help them, not with an air of superiority, but with a frank recognition that there was a point in our lives when we needed grace. And just to back this up, we come down to the next. And remember, Matthew is carefully constructing a chapter built around some common themes here. So you can't avoid the connection between what we've just read and moving down a little bit. And then Peter came up and said to him, "Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him?" So that's clearly what Peter is thinking. As soon as he hears this, the first thing that goes through his mind is, okay, how many times do I have to repeat this ridiculous process before I'm done with it? How many times do I have to go through this humbling and going to him and dealing with this because he's not savvy enough apparently to realize that he's offended me and he should be the one coming to me and saying, "I'm sorry"? How many times do I have to go to him? How many times does this process need to take place? And what's Jesus' answer essentially? Forever. Because as long as you are human, as long as they are human, there's going to be conflict, there's going to be disagreement, there's going to be hurt feelings and offense at times. And so this process needs to be ongoing. Do I need to tell you that in and of ourselves that's probably not going to happen? Do I need to remind us all that probably if we're not in God's presence once in a while, if we're not seeking His counsel, if we're not asking for His insights to help us see ourselves as we really are, we're probably not going to keep doing this. We're going to have Peter questions in our own life. And we're not going to get anywhere near 70 times 7. Now, 3 might be too many. I want to just go through this list at the end here very quickly, a couple of minutes, and then we're wrapped up. Practical steps for working through conflict. Disagreements will usually find vent in one form or another. In most cases, it's probably healthier to discuss a disagreement than to ignore it. Remember what we said? This thing that we do here on Saturday mornings, this what we're calling life school, is about becoming spiritually fit. Spiritually fit is the ability to respond well, the inner man's ability to respond well to outer situations. And so gradually, we said, we need to run toward problems rather than away from them. That when I have no spiritual strength, when I am timid and weak, I'm going to try to run away from things, which means I'm going to run away from conflicts. But as I become spiritually strong, I need to practice running toward the thing to find solution. So it's probably best not to avoid these things. Disagreements should usually be dealt with sooner rather than later if there are real consequences which will result from failure to bring closure to a conflict. How many of you have left the tough conversation unconversed for too long? Yeah. So it's not enough to be willing to have the conversation and promise yourself someday at the right time, right? Have you ever procrastinated because the time wasn't right? And I'm not saying that there doesn't need to be a right time, because there really does. But if you're human, right? You've experienced a few years of life. Have you ever found the ideal and perfect conditions to have anything? And so we need to be wise stewards of the time that's given to us. Time and place do matter. While difficult, it's best to show restraint and wait for a mutually agreed upon time. And isn't this the other tendency that we have? Okay, the one tendency is I'm never going to have the conversation. I'll put it off forever. But the other tendency is we're going to have this talk and we're going to have it when? Right now. Don't look at me like you're shocked when I raise my voice. This is not me, okay? While often difficult, it's usually best to isolate the point of disagreement from the person holding the disagreeable position. And we've talked about that. You and your ideas are not the same. I honor you even when I do not understand your position. Understand what's at stake before entering the discussion. And this is the part that Brian talked about. Know the cost of overlooking an offense. Proverbs even talks about that in certain cases, love demonstrates its love by overlooking an offense. Well, what kind of an offense do you overlook? I mean, if someone is going to kill your child, do you overlook that offense and pretend it's not there? Of course not. So it's asking for a measure of discernment. Is this offense worth going to blows over, having battle over? Do I compromise, or is this an item where I take a firm stand? And then the final point of guidance, pray. Honestly, and this is not that cliche-ish kind of, well, just pray about everything. This is pray for revelation, for insight, for personal evaluation. In other words, before you're going to have that tough conversation, have a private conversation with God and ask God to help you, prepare you for your side of the discussion. And at the same time, ask God's blessing on the other person and ask for God to guide them. And that doesn't mean for you to pray for God to ask them to show them the error of their ways. That may happen if there is some error in their way, but that is typically what our prayer is. God, show them how messed up they are. Please show them quickly. Help them to repent rapidly. Only if it's not true. Okay, gentlemen, I am done.